The Leader of the Opposition.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Prime Minister. Does she stand by all her government statements and actions?
The Right Honourable Prime Minister.
Mr. Speaker, yes. Particularly the government's work to prevent and respond to COVID-19, including the announcement last week by Ministers Robertson and Nash to provide interest-free loans of up to $100,000 for a year to small businesses impacted by COVID-19. And the announcement by Minister Parker that we will fast-track eligible development and infrastructure projects under the Resource Management Act to help get New Zealand moving again. The global pandemic is hitting every nation hard, and we are moving to cushion the blow for businesses and workers in this country.
What is Treasury's estimate of the number of New Zealanders that actually returned to work last week under Level 3, as opposed to the 75% being technically available to return to work because restrictions had been eased?
Speaker, my recollection is the estimates, and I will put emphasis on that, the estimates were an additional 400,000 New Zealanders.
Does she accept estimates from ANZ economists that New Zealand's economy will shrink by 10% this year, while Australia's will fall by less than 5%?
Mr. Speaker, I've seen a range of estimates. Ultimately, though, Mr. Speaker, what will be important are the final results coming out of both New Zealand and Australia, but you'll understand why, Mr. Speaker, my focus is on getting the New Zealand response right. Both the health response, which if we succeed is the best way we can support our economy by recovering quicker. Mr. Speaker, there are very few scenarios we can fall back on with previous global experience. In fact, we have to look back as far as the flu of 1918. But one of the learnings from that was that those countries that moved quickest and hardest to try and prevent the pandemic taking hold were also the economies that recovered the fastest.
Somebody question.
The Right Honourable wants to
did the Prime Minister also learn that the ANZ economist who was quoted on Q&A last night said that the New Zealand-Australia recovery percentage speed would be about the same?
Mr. Speaker, as I've said, I've heard a range of...
Order. Member resume her seat. I think the use of that pronoun back and forth is not that helpful. And I think it would be helpful if the interjections didn't go back and forth through the answer. So, Right Honourable Prime Minister, please start again.
Mr. Speaker, as the member will well know, my focus is on the New Zealand experience and making the right decision for New Zealanders.
Considering Australia and New Zealand have had almost identical health outcomes, why is she still imposing tougher restrictions on economic activity than Australia?
Mr. Speaker, again, as I've reiterated in this House multiple times, at the time that New Zealand took the decision it did to go into lockdown, which, as I recall, that member supported a mere 5 weeks ago, we had an infection rate modelled by the likes of Rodney Jones of 5. That was higher than Australia. We have a different population base, Mr. Speaker. But also, even the health professionals within Australia reference the fact that there is more in common with our response than there are differences. Mr. Speaker, as members in the House well know, I've been in fairly frequent dialogue with the leadership in Australia, and there are a lot of similarities with our approach. Each of us are now looking at removing restrictions and the phased approach in order to do that.
Rather than making a decision at the start of lockdown and then leaving it, shouldn't the Prime Minister make a new decision every single day about how she can safely get more businesses back to business, saving jobs and livelihoods in this country?
I'd love to see the members' evidence that that's not exactly what we are doing. We make decisions every day to look after people's lives and their livelihoods. What the member needs to remember, of course, is that we cannot get ahead of ourselves. We need to lock in all of the results we've had to date. We do have cycles of transmission with this virus we have to take into account, and we are listening to the evidence, the research, the best available advice to make our decisions, which is in the best interests of our economy as well.
Well, in light of that answer, is she telling the House that she may well bring forward the decision about whether to move to level two from Monday, and it could in fact be made this week?
As I also said in the answer I just gave, if the member was listening, is that we have to look at the cycle of transmission. Making a decision today based on a number today is a reflection of level four, not about where we are right now. Mr Speaker, that member may have the luxury of sitting on that side of the House, not bearing the consequences of a wrong move, but we do not. We have to factor in the livelihoods of every New Zealander.
What does she say to the business owner who emailed me to say, quote, we have a business in Australia as well as our New Zealand business. Our Australian business is pumping. Sales for March were well ahead of last year. Contrast that with our New Zealand business, close to zero both March and April. I don't think the government have any idea how bad things are going to get over here.
Mr Speaker, again, I hope that is a business, therefore, that accessed the more than $10 billion we've put into the wage subsidy to support those businesses.
Does she accept New Zealand's more extreme economic lockdown?
Order, Mr Brownlee. Well, I think the Leader of the Opposition doesn't need your assistance.
Mr Brownlee, I've been trying to be quite flexible during this period with people who are breaching the rules as to interjections. It is just not helpful when he interjects over the top of his leader's question. Mr Bridges.
Does she accept New Zealand's more extreme economic lockdown is why the IMF predicts New Zealand's unemployment rate will rise by 5.1% this year compared to just 2.4% in Australia?
Speaker, again, the member's assessment is premature. If he looks at even some of the decisions recently from credit rating agencies, for instance, they are talking about the resilience in the New Zealand economy. And Mr Speaker, of course, time will continue to tell. But I am confident that based on the investment we put in early, which included things like our wage subsidy, which went out the door faster than Australia's support, including our interventions to support businesses through IRD, including the small business loan scheme, and our focus on getting back to a level of normality and for businesses to operate as soon as possible, that will be then bear out in the results we have. It is simply premature to make comparisons. The final point I'll make is, having spoken to my Australia counterparts, there are more in common with our approach than the member describes.
Is your government taking into account the fact that there have been 1,000 job losses a day so far under lockdown, and its decision about whether to move out of level three next week?
Mr Speaker, of course we take into account economic impacts. We also take into account the economic impact of yo-yoing between levels and further outbreaks.
What of David Farris?
Question number two, the Honourable Paul Goldsmith.
You're gone. Head on the order.
To the Minister.
Mr Goldsmith.
To the Minister of Finance, what advice, if any, beyond the economic scenarios published on 14 April 2020, has he received from Treasury during the COVID-19 health and economic crisis?
The Honourable Grant Robertson.
Mr Speaker, as the member might imagine, I've received a considerable amount of advice from the Treasury on a wide range of matters during the time period that he specifies. This includes advice on the many announcements that the government has made, including advice on the wage subsidy scheme developed with the business community to protect jobs and incomes and keep businesses and workers connected during the lockdown. advice on the Small Business Cash Flow Loan Scheme to boost cash flow and help viable businesses with costs like rent, which has been welcomed by the business community. Advice on the Business Finance Guarantee Scheme, a partnership between the government and banks to get working capital out to business. And advice on the largest business tax support package in modern New Zealand history to support cash flow, encourage investment, and make it easier for businesses to manage their tax obligations during the crisis.
Why has none of this advice been released?
Mr. Speaker, decisions around the release of the advice are being taken under the normal rules that we have, Mr. Speaker, and I'm sure in time the member will receive it.
Does the Minister think this is in any way a normal situation where the normal rules of disclosure apply?
Mr. Speaker, as the member knows, I've realised the situation we're in. I've come to the Epidemic Response Committee on the occasions that I've been invited. I've provided information to that. And as I say, I'm sure the material the member wants will be released in due course.
Why does he not trust New Zealanders with this information now?
Mr. Speaker, I do trust New Zealanders.
What was the nature of Treasury's advice on the Small Business Cash Flow Loan Scheme mistakenly enacted last Thursday?
Mr. Speaker, I reject the premise of the member's question. This is a scheme that has been worked on for some time, including advice from the Treasury about how to best assist small businesses in addition to the wage subsidy scheme. It's a scheme that's been widely welcomed by people in the small business sector as one that will get money into their pockets and help with cash flow.
Supplementary, how could he possibly dispute the fact that the loan scheme was mistakenly enacted last Thursday?
Speaker, the loan scheme was intended to be announced this week. It ended up in a piece of legislation that I believe will be the subject of a later question on the order paper today. That was the outline, the framework of it. The loan scheme itself is something we're very proud of, and it's something that New Zealanders and New Zealand businesses will benefit from significantly.
Based on the advice he's received, what's the best estimate from Treasury of what the lockdown is costing the New Zealand economy each week?
Well, Mr. Speaker, as I think the member will be aware, the Treasury has done its scenarios which show the significant impact on the economy. As we've been discussing today, in Level 3, we're operating at about 75% output. On a per-day basis, I'll have to get back to the member.
Well, isn't the figure of $1.4 billion a week, based on the Treasury scenario of Level 3 dropping 25%, burned on his brain and keeping him awake at night?
Mr. Speaker, I find myself, after working like most members of this House are at the moment, about 18 hours a day, that when I do get to bed, I sleep relatively well. And then when I get up in the morning, Mr. Speaker, I work every minute of the day to make sure that New Zealand households and businesses get through this crisis and flourish at the other end.
Question number three, Kiritaku.
Mr. Speaker, my question is to the Minister of Māori Crown Relations. What actions has he taken to assist Māori in helping to keep communities safe from COVID-19?
The Honourable Kelvin Davis.
Mr. Speaker, before the country headed into Level 4, we announced the $56.5 million Māori response package to assist Māori in their fight against the spread of COVID-19. Māori were quick to activate their network and deliver practical support in the early stages of our fight against COVID-19. Their response was immediate, and we as a government worked with Māori to ensure the resources and funding announced in our Māori response package helped them in all the work they were undertaking. I'd like to thank iwi up and down the country for their hard work, for their cooperation, and for their future efforts as we move through these unprecedented times.
What did the Māori response package funding deliver to Māori?
Mr. Speaker, this package was able to support 43 Māori groups and iwi develop their own pandemic response plans. It delivered business support and advice to 632 businesses. It enabled 2,029 interactions with Māori business via an 0800 number. It provided extra funding to Māori health providers and Māori-led testing stations and it helped Māori to resource volunteers to reach out to our most vulnerable and isolated communities, and in particular our kaumātua and kuia.
Demetrisu, how did this funding provide support for vulnerable Māori whānau across Aotearoa?
Speaker, this funding helps support some of our most vulnerable communities, in particular kaumātua and kuia and those in isolated areas. Part of the package was to boost the work of whānau order commissioning agencies who, because of the Māori response package, were able to deliver close to 120,000 care packages to vulnerable whānau, and over 64,000 whānau members have received support through commissioning agencies. This proves that when Māori and the Crown work in partnership, we can successfully deliver to Māori across the country.
Question number four, the Honourable Todd McLean.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. To the Minister of Tourism, what action, if any, will he take this week to save businesses and jobs in the tourism sector?
Mr. Speaker, this week, like every week since this government has been responding to COVID-19, we will continue to support tourism businesses through our economic response package, which includes wage subsidy assistance, the business finance guarantee scheme, changes in tax provisions, as well as the tax loss carryback scheme, small business cash flow loan scheme, changes to the tax loss continuity rules, and further business consultancy support.
Thank you. Will he confirm today that wage subsidies will be extended for tourism businesses who this week face laying off staff so that these New Zealanders can keep their jobs?
Mr. Speaker, in consultation with the tourism sector, that is one of the they would like certainty around the tax, the wage subsidies scheme. Those sorts of decisions will be made by the appropriate ministers at the appropriate time. The wage subsidy scheme, the Minister of Finance, was the architect of that. It's not a decision that the Minister of Tourism makes by himself.
Will he today confirm that tourism businesses will receive cash flow grants rather than government debt so they have certainty and Kiwis can keep their jobs?
Well, Mr. Speaker, I've already rattled through a list of things that tourism businesses can access. And to just expand on that a bit further, there's up to $12 billion in wage subsidies so that affected businesses can keep their staff. There's $2.8 billion in business tax changes to reduce cash flow pressure, including provisional tax threshold lift, the reinstatement of building depreciation, writing off interest on late payment of tax. There's an initial $600 million package to help the aviation sector. There's $6.25 billion business finance guarantee scheme for small and medium-sized businesses. There's further support for SMEs, including $3.1 billion tax loss carryback scheme, as I've said, changes to the tax loss continuity rules, further business consultancy support. There's greater flexibility for affected businesses to meet their tax obligations. The government has done a heck of a lot to help businesses, not just tourism businesses.
Will he tell tourism business?
How is he ensuring that the tourism sector is involved in his work to respond and restart the industry in a post-COVID world?
Mr. Speaker, so as the Minister, I've hosted a webinar. By the end of this week, we should have been in touch with over 3,000 people from the tourism industry, tourism operators and businesses. I'll continue to host multiple regional webinars every week, where each webinar involves about 150-plus tourism operators. Tourism New Zealand's also engaging on contact with industry players to ensure everyone gets a chance to be part of the restart of our tourism industry in a post-COVID New Zealand.
Speaker, will you tell tourism businesses today what restrictions they will face under Level 2 and whether New Zealanders will be able to travel domestically so these businesses can this week make decisions to save jobs?
Well, again, Mr. Speaker, if the member waits until Thursday, then a lot will be revealed. But the thing is, tourism operators have said to me that they want certainty around the wage subsidy scheme. They want restrictions on domestic travel lifted, and they would like a trans-Tasman bubble to be created. The thing is that all of those decisions are made by other ministers, where I where I have input and represent the interests of the tourism industry on the behalf of the tourism industry. But one thing I will not do is stand up and undermine my fellow ministers by talking out of turn on areas that impact their portfolios.
The Right Honourable Prime Minister.
Supplementary, can the Minister confirm that on the last opportunity that myself as Prime Minister had to sit with tourism operators in Rotorua, they highlighted the importance of a successful campaign against COVID being part of their recovery so that people can look to New Zealand both from a tourism perspective in the future but also from a trade perspective with confidence in our response?
Mr. Speaker, that's right. Do it once and do it right. We know that the best thing for our economy is to stamp out COVID-19 and not to risk going up and down between levels. That will be the worst thing ever for not just tourism, but for the whole economy.
Will he give certainty to the tourism sector today about when his government hopes to open the Trans-Tasman border and under what conditions so these businesses can keep people in work and save jobs?
Mr. Speaker, I have it on good authority that the Australian Cabinet are still meeting about this very issue. And again, these are issues. If we're talking about lifting border restrictions, we need to talk to the Minister of Foreign Affairs, the Minister of Immigration, the Minister of Customs, and certainly the Minister of Health. I represent the interests of the tourism sector, and I make sure that my colleagues know exactly what the tourism sector wants. And we're heading in the right direction. That is the best thing that we can do.
Question number five, the Honourable Louise Upston.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Minister for Social Development and asks, what action is she taking, if any, to support the more than 1,000 people who have lost their jobs and gone onto job seeker support each day since the lockdown?
Speaker, on behalf of the Minister for Social Development, supporting people into work has always been part of this government's agenda, which is why at last year's budget we announced an investment into 263 new work-focused case managers. We acted in early March, establishing rapid response teams to support redeployment activities all across MSD regions. This has continued through the lockdown. We established the wage subsidy scheme and leave support schemes that have supported over 1.7 million Kiwis to stay connected to their employers. Last week, I announced a range of initiatives to keep New Zealand working, including an online recruitment tool. We have 35 new employment centres that are up and running and operating virtually to work with employers and clients to support accelerated redeployment.
How many applications for job seeker support have there been since the start of Alert Level 4, and how many have been declined?
Well, Mr. Speaker, in reference to the second part of the question, I don't have that information with me around declines. What I can say from publicly available information to the member is that it is around the 30,000 mark of additional people on the job seeker support.
Supplementary. Does she have any estimates of how many people have lost their job since the start of Alert Level 4 but were not eligible for job seeker support?
Mr. Speaker, the member would need to put a specific question like that down in writing.
Does she believe that the 1,000 people going on job seeker support each day has peaked, or will this number increase when the wage subsidy ends in a month?
Mr. Speaker, our forecasts around what will happen with New Zealand's unemployment rate have been provided by a large number of people. As with other countries in the world, there is an expectation that we are facing a period of significant economic downturn. The government is and will continue to do everything in our power to limit the number of people who find themselves in need of job seeker support.
What recent reports has she read, if any, on the social and health impacts of unemployment, and what actions is she taking to reduce this harm?
Speaker, on behalf of the Minister, I'm not sure exactly what reports the Minister will have read around the health impacts of unemployment, but it's certainly an issue that the Minister and this Government are very well aware of. It's why we have worked so hard to reduce unemployment in New Zealand, taking it down to its lowest levels in a decade in the period leading up to COVID-19, and we'll continue to take that approach of prioritising reducing unemployment and hope to continue the success that we've had with that up until COVID-19.
Question number six, Jenny Anderson.
Tēnā koe te māngai. My question is to the Minister of Finance. What actions has the government taken to support businesses and households to respond to COVID-19?
The government's ability to support businesses and households is backed by our actions to ensure a strong underlying economic base for the New Zealand economy and our strong fiscal position going into COVID-19. Standard & Poor's yesterday held New Zealand's credit rating at AA+ with a positive outlook because of the government's low debt relative to the rest of the world and the economy's underlying strength. This has allowed the government to go hard and early in our economic response to COVID-19 to match our health response. This has been led by the $10.7 billion wage subsidy scheme, supporting more than 1.7 million workers, the business finance guarantee scheme, the largest business tax support package in modern New Zealand history, and further measures announced last week to support small businesses with cash flow and operating costs.
What actions is the government taking to support small businesses through COVID-19?
Speaker, on Friday, the government announced the Small Business Cash Flow Loan Scheme to provide graduated loans of up to $100,000 to viable businesses with 50 or fewer employees to give them access to cash flow to meet fixed costs such as rent. The scheme will provide $10,000 to each eligible firm and, in addition, $1,800 per equivalent full-time employee. The interest rate will be 3% for a maximum of 5 years, with repayments not required for the first 2 years. The loans will be interest-free if they are repaid within the first year. IRD will have the scheme up and running by May 12 to start accepting applications, and we expect the first lending decisions to be made about 48 hours after applications are received.
What reports has he seen of reactions to the Small Business Cash Flow Loan Scheme?
Speaker, many. EMA Chief Executive Brett O'Reilly said his members would welcome the Small Business Cash Flow Loan Scheme. He said the terms of the scheme are very similar to the Canadian approach, which we and other members of the Business New Zealand Network encouraged the government to look at. We thank the Minister of Finance, Grant Robertson, for this response. Mr Speaker, I've also received letters of support and emails from a number of other small businesses and, indeed, the Mayor of the Queenstown Lakes District Council, Jim Bolt, on behalf of the businesses in Queenstown. This scheme has been welcomed.
Jamie Lee Ross.
Will the government further support businesses and households by legislating for a rates freeze for the 2020-21 local government rating year? If not, why not?
Mr Speaker, that is not the intention of the government.
The Right Honourable Winston Peters.
Has the Minister had regard to a more recently announced scheme in the last 24 hours where businesses will not be able to qualify unless they can prove they had a 50% loss?
I've seen a number of ideas proposed in recent times. One of the things that's important in these situations is to have consistency. And I certainly know that in the case of the people proposing that scheme, last week they were describing our scheme as both too loose and too restrictive within hours of each other. Mr Goldsmith and Mr McClay should have a chat with one another.
Why is the government not considering providing relief to businesses and households by legislating for a rates freeze?
Mr Speaker, we believe that local government needs to make its own decisions about the level of rates that it's charging at this time. Many of them have responsibilities to co-fund projects that are important to productivity and creating jobs. I'm sure that each local government authority will think very carefully about the level of rates that they charge in this environment.
Question number 7, Dr Shane Retty.
Thank you, Mr Speaker. To the Associate Minister of Health, does she agree with Dr Ashley Bloomfield that all New Zealanders are now able to get a flu jab?
Tēnā koe, Mr
the
Speaker.
The Honourable Julianne Jenner.
Yes, on Monday the 27th of March, the prioritisation criteria that the government had put in place to ensure our most vulnerable were able to get their flu vaccine was lifted. This means that all New Zealanders are now eligible to ring their GP or pharmacist and make an appointment to get vaccinated. In previous years, there was never a prioritisation system put in place. So this year, we acted early to ensure the most at-risk New Zealanders had a head start on getting their flu vaccine in this unprecedented time of a global pandemic.
Parliamentary, how does that align with her statement this Saturday that, quote, not every New Zealander will get a flu vaccine, unquote?
Well, Mr. Speaker, as we have maintained the entire time, we have a record number of flu vaccines this year. That's 1.768 million. He will realise that that is less than the population of New Zealand. Nonetheless, in previous years, one out of four New Zealanders got a flu vaccine. This year, we're on track for more than one out of three. And we already have record numbers of people over the age of 65 have been vaccinated. That's on the NIR. More Māori over the age of 65 have been vaccinated than in any previous year. And that's with us only having the records of about 770,000 vaccines. So there's still yet a million vaccines to either be administered or for the records to come through.
Supplementary. What does she say then to New Zealanders who may eventually miss out on a flu vaccine because there are not enough?
I would say that there's very low risk of flu this year. The flu tracker is showing that we have record low levels of the flu due to the borders being closed and all of the precautions that we are taking to prevent the spread of COVID-19. We are also preventing the spread of the flu. And we have already vaccinated record numbers of vulnerable people. So I think the clinical outcome of this year's flu vaccine is excellent. And I want to thank all those hardworking GPs, nurses and pharmacists who have been vaccinating people at twice the rate of last year. An excellent outcome.
Supplementary. Why is this the second winter in a row under her watch when the front line have had no flu vaccines when they needed them?
Mr. Speaker, I'm really not sure what the member is referring to. This is actually the first year that I've had the delegation for this, firstly. But secondly, I believe that some GPs are running low, and that is because they are vaccinating people at twice the rate of last year. Also, we're in the midst of a global pandemic with unprecedented travel restrictions, both internationally and nationally, and that has led to some distribution issues. But everybody is working as hard as they possibly can, and the clinical outcome so far is so good. I think GPs, nurses, and pharmacists are going to look back on the outcome of this year and the record numbers of vulnerable people who were vaccinated and say, this was a very big clinical success.
Mentory. When people look back, will it be the same distribution issue she has mentioned now as the distribution issue she quoted for the flu vaccine last year and the measles vaccine?
Mr. Speaker, I think that the circumstances that we're facing right now with a global pandemic and a 90% reduction in international travel and significant reductions in inter-regional travel here in New Zealand are not comparable to issues with that we've previously had with vaccines, no. But I will come back to the outcome is very good because GPs have actually been vaccinating people at twice the rate they had last year. They have had significant supplies. They've administered them to a record numbers of New Zealanders. And we still have a million vaccines to either be administered or to be entered for the records to come through on the NIR. So.
Question number eight, Kieran McInerney. A point of order, the Honourable Dr. Nick Smith.
Mr. Speaker, I seek leave to table an email from my own Nelson Marlborough DHB received today saying they have run out of flu vaccinations.
Is there any objection to that occurring? There is none. Question number eight, Kieran McInerney.
To the Minister of Education.
Order! Kieran McInerney.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. To the Minister of Education, what actions has the government taken to ensure that students in need can access support to learn online in tertiary education?
The Honourable Chris Hipkins.
Mr. Speaker, the government announced over the weekend $20 million for technology access for tertiary students so that we can make digital devices and internet connections available for students who do not otherwise have those in their homes. While online learning is being undertaken by tertiary organisations in response to COVID-19, many students don't have access to the appropriate devices or the appropriate internet connections to enable them to undertake technology-enabled learning. Many students still go onto the campus in order to access equipment to learn. Since the country moved into lockdown, officials have worked with the tertiary institutes to identify the number of students.
Order, order, order.
Look, I apologise to the member, and with my previous history, I'm reluctant to say it, but if members want to do something like that, they should take it outside. Chris Hopkins, continue.
Mr Speaker, when the country moved into lockdown, officials worked with tertiary institutes to identify the number of students who they thought didn't have access to the right devices and didn't have broadband internet. So the $20 million fund is part of our overall response, which of course includes the $87.7 million that the government is funding across schools and early learning services for devices, connections and hard packs of materials.
Supplementary. How many learners were identified as needing support for digital devices and technology?
Mr Speaker, the work undertaken by the institutions identified that around 11,150 learners at tertiary organisations could not, probably don't have appropriate devices to engage in technology-enabled learning, while a slightly higher number, 11,350, don't have access to broadband at home. The package that we are funding provides for devices and internet connections for up to 18,500 learners.
Supplementary. How will this money be distributed to universities, PTEs, polytechnics and Wānanga?
Mr Speaker, in the first instance, half of the fund is being allocated to tertiary organisations on the basis of the number of learners that they have, with a particular weighting to priority learners. For example, the New Zealand Institute of Skills and Technology has been allocated $2.3 million to start purchasing devices and connections. The second half of the fund will be available on application from organisations.
Supplementary, how will students be selected for support for devices and internet connections from the universities, Wānanga, PTEs and polytechnics?
Mr Speaker, we want to make it as easy as possible to get these resources to the students that need them, and we want to enable institutions to use their existing supply chains where possible. So the funding is being allocated to the institutions, and the students that need them should speak to their university, Wānanga, PTE or Polytech in the first instance.
The Honourable Nikki Kaye.
How does that support students that are currently locked out of their accommodation, paying bills to their tertiary providers? How are they going to benefit from that online learning?
Oh, Mr Speaker, if the accommodation that they are in does not have broadband access or does not have a device that they can use to access the internet and to access online learning, then they will be able to do that. With regard to the institutions continuing to charge rent for rooms that students are unable to occupy, I've been very clear around my expectations on that. Those institutions, or those organisations, I should say, that are accessing the wage subsidy should not be charging full rent to the students for rooms that they cannot use. The universities in particular have a very healthy balance sheet position, which means that they do not need to take some of the measures that they are taking now. And I expect them to behave responsibly and with a degree of compassion towards their learners.
Question number 9, the Honourable Jerry Brownie.
Mr Speaker, my question is to the Minister of Revenue. Did he know that the Small Business Cash Flow Loan Scheme was in the COVID-19 response taxation and other regulatory urgent measures bill that was introduced to Parliament on Thursday, the 30th of April? If so, why didn't he notify the opposition that the scheme was not in the bill, that the scheme was not in the bill supplied to them that morning?
The Honourable Chris Hipkins.
Mr Speaker, on behalf of the Minister of Revenue, no. The government had directed that the bill be divided into two, with the Small Business Loan Scheme to be progressed through a separate subsequent bill. A miscommunication between the IRD and the Parliamentary Council Office resulted in an earlier version of the bill being tabled. I was not made aware of the error until after the House had concluded its business for the day. I regret that the version of the bill supplied to the opposition differed to the one that was tabled. The Leader of the House has received an apology from the Chief Parliamentary Counsel for the error, and I seek leave for that letter to now be tabled.
Is there any objection to that occurring? There appears to be none.
Mr Speaker, has he had discussions with the Leader of the House that would lead to any bills that might be coming in to the House next week, in his name, being provided to the opposition ahead of them being tabled in the House so that there can be no confusion about what is in them and what their purpose is?
Mr Speaker, yes, there have been several conversations between myself as the Minister of Revenue and the Leader of the House around expectations around this. Also, there have been conversations between the Leader of the House and the Chief Parliamentary Counsel around how to ensure that this sort of error can never happen again in the future. And the Chief Parliamentary Counsel has initiated an independent review to ensure that the process is tightened up.
The question was, will the Minister, if he has bills coming into the House next week in his name, make those bills available to the opposition ahead of time or ahead of them being tabled in a more timely fashion so that there can be no doubt about the purpose of the bills that are being put in front of the Parliament?
Mr Speaker, the shorter answer to that question is yes, and that is what the government endeavoured to do last week. The copy of the bill that had been approved by ministers for introduction was supplied to the opposition. The Parliamentary Council Office introduced a different version of the bill.
Can we take it from the Minister's answer that there will be no taxation bills in the urgency motion next week?
Mr Speaker, no.
The Right Honourable Winston Peters.
That said, is it the job of the opposition to oppose and propose, to forensically examine bills before Parliament, and that democracy
a
only works...
Order.
No, don't tell me to do that. The member will be in real trouble. A point of order, the Honourable Gerry Brownlee.
Well, Mr Speaker, I think it's pretty clear where this question is going, and so I just want to make it clear that we do understand what the role of the opposition is. But the bill
order,
was,
order, well, order. Now the member will resume his seat. I was giving the Right Honourable Gentleman a chance to get his question into order. It seemed to me the further it went along, the further away he got from it. So I'm not going to give him another shot. We're just going to move on.
Question number 10, the Honourable Dr Nick Smith.
Thank you, Mr Speaker. My question is to the Minister of Justice. Does he stand by all his policies and priorities?
The Honourable Andrew Little.
I stand by all the policies and priorities of the government.
Why is the government rushing his legislation to extend voting rights for prisoners during a national emergency when the government stated at the beginning of lockdown, and I quote, all parliamentary business before select committees that is not COVID-related will be suspended?
Mr Speaker, the bill to which the member refers is in the hands of the select committee. It is not a matter over which I have any control. It is a bill that is in the control of the select committee.
Tree. How can the minister say he has no control of the bill before the select committee when the other two bills before the Justice Select Committee, one on sexual violence and one on first responders, the Minister has written to the Business Committee seeking an extension of time? And is it the government's priorities that prisoners' rights are ahead of those of victims of sexual violence or first responders?
A point of order, Chris. The Honourable Chris Hipkin.
Mr Speaker, there has to be a factual inaccuracy in the assertion made in that question. Ministers do not write to the Business Committee seeking extensions for bills. Select committees write to the Business Committee seeking extensions.
Speaking to the point of order, the Honourable Dr Nick Smith.
The standing orders of the House are that the member in charge of a bill can advise the Business Committee as to whether they approve the extension. Mm. In the case of the sexual violence legislation before the Justice Select Committee, Minister has...
Right, I get the member's point. Unfortunately, the way he expressed his question didn't quite get there. I am going to give him another shot at getting the question accurate.
Why has the Minister written to the Business Committee approving an extension of time for other justice bills like the sexual violence legislation, but not the prisoner voting legislation, when the prisoner voting legislation is on fast track and when the rights of rape victims should come ahead of the rights of prisoners?
Okay, I'll let the member answer the question, and I will just get it in order by saying indicating support for rather than approving.
Mr. Speaker, again, any correspondence I've had with the Business Committee is in relation to a request by the Chair of the Select Committee and is not a matter over which I assert any control.
Supplementary. Does the Minister agree with Professor Andrew Geddes of Otago University that his bill in Clause 8, and I quote, gives prisoners more electoral rights than other citizens, close quotes? If so, is it government policy that convicted criminals have greater rights than victims of crime and other law-abiding citizens?
Mr. Speaker, for the second time, this member has asked two questions, not one, and he's about to do it again.
Well, I accept that the member has very long phrases that make up his questions, but he's so far in order. I'll ask Dr. Nick Smith to start again.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Does the Minister agree with Professor Andrew Geddes of Otago University that his bill in Clause 8, quote, gives prisoners more electoral rights than other citizens? If so, is it government policy that convicted criminals have greater rights than victims of crime or law-abiding citizens?
Mr. Speaker, in answer to the second part of the question, no.
Supplementary. Can the Minister confirm that he has written to the Justice Select Committee stating that officials will not be able to provide full answers to the committee's questions or a comprehensive departmental report on the bill? And if so, why would we continue to rush such legislation?
No, well, that is out of order. Further supplementary?
Supplementary. Can the Minister assure the House that the Justice Select Committee will have access to a comprehensive report from his ministry and that the ministry will be able to answer all of the committee's questions thoroughly?
Mr. Speaker, as far as I know, that is exactly what ministry officials are providing to that committee.
Chris, a point of order, the Honourable Dr. Nick Smith.
Mr. Speaker, the answer that the Minister has just given contradicts the letter that he has written to the Select Committee.
Dr. Smith, you are the most senior member of the House. The one with the most experience, anyway. No, he's not that either. All right, okay. He's the father of the House, let's put it that way. The member has a question. If he wants to ask it, he'll just zip it up. Dr. Smith, the member has been here for a long time and he should know what assertions he can and can't make by way of point of order. And the fact that he disagrees with an answer is certainly not a reason for a point of order. If we had that, we'd have one of those on just about every supplementary answer in the House.
Order, Mr. Speaker.
A point of order, the Honourable Gerry Browning.
Speaking to the point of order, I appreciate your ruling and just seek advice. If the substance of that question was prefaced with has, would that put it in order? Because it seems to me we're getting into some pretty pedantic sort of space. We're in unusual times. The opposition has agreed to truncated versions of Parliament because it's the right thing to do at the moment, but on the basis that the business as usual sort of stuff would be pushed off until a later time and probably facilitated at that later time. But in this case, clearly there is a hell-bent desire by someone to get this piece of legislation through. It's not unreasonable to question whether or not that is actually being driven by the Minister. And a question, has he written, would that stand as opposed to the question that was asked by Dr. Smith?
Well, I didn't rule out the question in that particular case that was asked. What I said was that I wasn't saying that the member
has to be happy with the answer. And taking a point of order to say that he disagrees with the answer, it didn't matter really what the question was, because the question was ruled in, to say that the member was unhappy with the answer is not the case. If there is an allegation that the minister was inaccurate, and deliberately so, the member knows how that should be taken up. If the member has other evidence that he thinks contradicts it and would cause the minister to correct his answer, then he could be kind enough either to pass it to the minister or to table it in the House. And that way it would put more pressure on the minister to correct his answer if, in fact, it was inaccurate. Point of order of the Honourable Dr Nick Smith.
Thank you, Mr Speaker. I seek leave of the House to table the Minister of Justice's letter to the Justice Select Committee saying that justice officials would not be able to provide complete answers or the normal standard of departmental report.
Is there any objection to that?
Yes.
There is. The Honourable Chris Hopkins.
Thank you, Mr Speaker. Can the Minister confirm that the bill does little more than reverse a law change passed by the previous government with the narrowest of margins in the House?
Mr Speaker, that is precisely what the bill does, and it is a bill that has also been the subject of questions and submissions made to that committee in the last 2 years under different types of legislation that could have touched on that question. The issues that are in the bill are not new to the current makeup of the Justice Committee.
Supplementary question, the Honourable Dr Nick Smith.
Can the Minister confirm that Clause 8 of the bill before the Select Committee, that Professor Andrew Geddes has not only pointed out is new, but confers on prisoners rights that victims and other citizens do not have and has never been on the law books of New Zealand before? Clause 8.
Mr Speaker, I understand that the committee has received submissions and indeed advice from officials to that effect. That has never been the intention of the government, but it is in the hands of that committee to make a change to make sure that the provision of that clause is consistent with the rights that every other citizen has, and I eagerly await the recommendations, unanimous recommendations of that committee to that effect.
Supplementary question, the right honourable.
Is it not a fact, with respect to that last question, that until 2011, that was the extant situation on the law, supported by Holyoake, Marshall, Muldoon, and dare I say, Jim Bulger and others? Then all of a sudden it changed. So Professor Geddes is profoundly wrong.
Order, order. This member has responsibility neither for Professor Geddes or history. Question number 11, the Right Honourable Winston Peters.
On behalf of myself, sorry, to the Minister for Regional Economic Development, what recent announcements has he made regarding regional economic development?
The Honourable Shane Jones.
Mr Speaker, the dispenser of the provincial panacea has the following to say. During the COVID period four, phase four, great work took place to recalibrate and repurpose the Provincial Growth Fund. And, sir, I can announce as of today, because digital connectivity is incredibly important and many areas in New Zealand were left neglected in a former period of 9 years, places including Murupara, Gisborne, Katikati, will now enjoy the presence of five new digital hubs. And in addition to that, sir, last week, over $439 million worth of investment in 60 PGF projects begun to work in earnest after moving into level three. That, sir, is evidence that this government is quick on the fiscal trigger. And, sir, we have also seen iconic projects that were neglected, unfortunately, but brought to life by the Provincial Growth Fund in the form of the Hundavasa Arts Centre, the Taranaki Crossing, the Westport Airport seawall, places in those areas of New Zealand that have suffered far too much neglect in the period of time of the former regime.
Supplementary question. How will he ensure that progress on projects happens quickly during the post-COVID-19 recovery?
Sir, I'm incredibly pleased to have worked with my colleague, Mr. David Parker, and his announcements to fast-track a consenting process so that projects crucial to the recovery will not be subjected to undue delay through RMA processes. This, sir, lays bare the extent of the former government's failure to reform the RMA, instead, sir, leaving us with a type of bureaucratic voodoo. It has fallen, sir, to this particular group of ministers to do what the former regime could not do. And this is incredibly important, because jobs are very important.
Point of order, the Honourable Paula Bennett.
Point of order, Mr Speaker, there is a general debate tomorrow, and I think that is the time for ministers to make speeches. These answers are incredibly long.
The member is absolutely right. They are incredibly long, but tangentially they are relevant. And I will remind the member, as she knows, because she's been around here a while, that responsibility for the interruption on the length of answers is mine and not hers, not to be raised by way of point of order. Oh, Mr Brownlee, the Honourable Mr Brownlee.
Thank you, Mr Speaker. I would have thought, sir, that you might have had a greater interest in the answers from ministers being more forward-focused than the jaundiced history that's constantly presented to the House by the Honourable Shane Jones. Now, his own fixation on the past is interesting. It does reflect in most of his policies, but in essence, at the present time, where the country is facing significant economic challenge, as well as the health challenge that New Zealand's have so well risen to, it would be appropriate, I think, that you did require that he speaks more to the future than to the past.
Well, I want to sort of thank members for their advice and to say to the Leader of the Opposition, his interjection during his colleague's point of order probably made up for what happened earlier in the day. I will listen very carefully to the answers, but I will say to the member that I thought his point of order was something which was approaching something that Paula, the Honourable Paula Bennett, was suggesting earlier. It was more a contribution to a debate rather than a serious point of order. Supplementary question, the Right Honourable.
Is the Minister saying that, having been wrongly blamed for 9 long years of non-reform of the RMA, he took that experience to collegially work with the Honourable David Parker to get dramatic change right here and right now?
Sir, in the very short term, the RMA will be reformed. Sir, in a very short period of time, projects will proceed with alacrity because jobs are essential. Bureaucratic entanglement is something that the future does not find a place for, that type of activity, which is why, sir, as the provincial champion, my colleagues on the other side of the House will find great worthiness in this transformational initiative which I am championing.
Supplementary question, the Honourable Judith Collins.
Does the Minister, looking back to the past, remember how many times New Zealand First supported any amendments to the RMA in the last 9 years?
No. Order. I think the member's probably the most experienced member of the front bench of the opposition, and she knows that that question is out of order. The Honourable Gerry Brownlee.
Mr Speaker, to the Minister, given his very bold claims in the House today, can he assure the House that the government has the numbers to pass the provisions that he's so boldly claiming will make such a difference?
Mr Speaker.
We are such a collegial crowd on our side of the House.
The Right Honourable Winston Peters.
With respect to the last question, did he hear Morning Report and the effusive support from the National Party for this dynamic legislation? That being the case, how will he assist the COVID-19 economic recovery being balanced and resolved to meet the challenges faced by the long, hitherto neglected regions?
The Honourable Gerry Brownlee.
Which one of those questions on two different topics is allowed to be answered by the Minister?
Well,
completely different topics.
Well, what I'm trying to work out, Mr. Brownlee, is whether I should lift my standards or not in relation to the linking of legs of supplementary questions. I think that I tried to tighten up not very long ago and was subject to some pretty intense criticism from members not very far away from him. I am in this matter, you know, my natural inclination is actually to agree with the member and to be very tight, but I want to say that if I do, there would have been at least 10 of today's questions would have been ruled out, and they all came from his side of the house. So I'm not going to rule that way now, but if a member wants to come back to me and say that it's a view of the opposition, that the supplementary questioning should be tightened up with regard to relevance and the relationship with prior supplementary questions or prior answers, then I would be more than happy to oblige the opposition.
Speaker. In contrast to the other member, I shall demonstrate my verbal acrobatic skills. There is a serious drought, for example, sir, affecting Northland. That is a simple example of one of the challenges the government inherited, with poor outcomes with water storage in those neglected parts of the country, which is why we are going to charge ahead and deal with the anxieties and the uncertainties as the primary sector generates more wealth in the post-COVID environment, marrying land to water, equaling greater prosperity.
Question number 12, Jenny Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Minister of Health. How has the rollout of new frontline mental health services been affected by COVID-19?
The Honourable Dr. David Clark.
Mr. Speaker, despite disruptions caused by the global COVID-19 pandemic, work has continued on the rollout of the free frontline mental health and addiction services funded through Budget 2019. By June next year, 1.5 million New Zealanders will have access to free mental health care at their GP or primary care outlet. This work is well underway, with more than 100 sites receiving a combined investment of $40 million in this rollout. Rolling out such an ambitious new service requires an entirely new workforce. We've made sure not to lose momentum during the lockdown and have adapted the training so that it can be delivered virtually.
How has the provision of these services been affected by COVID-19?
Mr. Speaker, I'm pleased to report that services have continued to be delivered via phone and video conferencing throughout alert levels 4 and 3. And more broadly, mental health services have always been considered an essential service. Therefore, their provision has continued throughout all COVID-19 alert levels.
Other extra mental health support has the government made available to New Zealanders feeling the effects of COVID-19?
Mr. Speaker, many people across New Zealand will be feeling distress or anxiety about the future because of COVID-19. I want people to know that it is normal to feel this way in times of uncertainty and that there is a range of free support available. Over the past weeks, the government has announced online information for parents, awareness campaigns, apps, e-therapy and tools to help people maintain their mental well-being throughout this unusual time. These tools have been brought on stream quickly to complement a wider package of support such as face-to-face sessions and the 1737 number.
That concludes oral questions.